All right, so this last session I'm going to talk about how to have to store data on the stack as well as in the register. So far we've only covered registers, and that is certainly not enough if you have parameters. There we just already we stored all the live registers that were currently used in the function, and we stored them on the stack in order to be able to reuse them in the called function. So there we already saw a use of the stack for storing data. Okay. So the one important distinction in every programming language is that there are expressions, and usually we write the result of an expression somewhere. And there is a very big difference what we can write on the left-hand side of an equal sign and what we can write on the right-hand side. So first of all, we need to distinguish these two things. So on the right-hand side, all we need to know is the value of the expression. And if we have if it's a composed expression here, for instance, y, we need the value of y. But for the left-hand side, here it's an array access, we need to know the address so we know where to write the result to. So if we have a simple variable like y on the left-hand side, we don't need to know what the value of y is, but where y is stored. So that's a big difference when we don't want to generate code. So the left and right-hand side of this assignment equality sign also defines these two notions, the right R value for the right-hand side, so that is the content of x if we're asking for the R value. And if we're asking for the L value of x, it's the address. So if x is on the left-hand side, we want the address, and if it's on the right-hand side, we want its value. And then we can compute the value and store it in the address of x. So, and for this, we define two code generation functions. So far, we've seen code R for the R value to evaluate the value of an expression. We've seen normal code without any subscript, which was for statements. And now we'll have a new function called code L for the L value. So it's computing an address of the given expression. And this also has, so code L cannot be applied to any expression. It can only apply to things that can occur on the left-hand side of an assignment. So for instance, x plus 1 does not have an L value. There is no address where we can write to x plus 1 so that x, say, gets the value minus 1. That's not how C works and most imperative and functional languages work. You can only do that in Prolog. Okay, so for dealing with L values, we need to be able to also talk about more generically where variables are stored. So far, variables are only always stored in registers. But that's not the whole truth. Variables can also be global. So while the program is running, there is some absolute address where a variable is stored. Those are global variables. And nowadays, there's thread local variables, which are as like global variables, but individual to each thread that is running. Then we have local variables. Local variables are those variables that are declared inside the function. They're also called automatic variables in C. And then there are register variables, which you can even declare in C, but the compiler doesn't have to do to store their contents in a register. But you can still declare it. Most compilers will just ignore it because they'll use registers anyway, eventually for most of the variables. So we have now three storage classes, and our symbol table will now use these letters GLR to say where a variable is stored. So our new symbol table maps variables to one of these tags, GLR, and an offset Z, so any integer number. So, and in particular, these three interpretations are as follows. The one we know already, if row of X maps to R, A, that means that X is stored in register A. So we had that so far. And then now we have variables inside the function, then X could be local. So in this case, a local variable will be stored relative to the frame pointer that we've seen already with the functions, and we'll make that we'll now use the frame pointer that always, when we call a function and run a function, we might have more or less members, other like saved registers and so on the stack. But the frame pointer always points to the beginning of the stack frame, and since we all our variables are stored relative to the beginning of the stack frame, so in order to access the eighth value on the stack frame, we just access the value the address FP plus A. Okay, so global variables, the first entry here, is much simpler. In the symbol table, a global variable is only stored with a tag G and the absolute address A. So whenever we want to access a variable that is stored as a global variable, we'll just look up in the symbol table, and this is the address, the global address. Okay. Normally, obviously, a variable only has one entry in the symbol table. However, we could have a different symbol table for each program point, namely if sometimes a variable is stored in the main memory, and sometimes it's stored in a register, depending on if we were able to do some clever optimizations, we might be able to store a variable inside a register for some time and then move it back to memory. But we only consider, for simplicity, we only consider that a variable is either living in memory as a local variable, or is a global variable, or is a register variable. And I'll say how to decide this in a second. Okay, so in general, we could be more permissive and say that at some program point, X lives in a register, and at a different program point, it lives in memory. But we won't do that here. Okay, so why do we actually need to store variables in memory? Yeah. Did I say four? I meant three. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Well, you could say thread local storage, but we don't do that. Okay. Does it say? Oh, dear. Yeah. Well, I think what I wanted to say here is like there's a local register and there's global registers. I think those are my four ways. So let's say three to four ways, depending on how you count. Well spotted. Okay. So why do we need to store variables in memory? Well, if we had an infinite supply of registers, one could think, well, maybe we can just use all our infinite registers, even though it's not very realistic. So one thing are global variables. So we could say for global variables, we just use global registers. If we have an infinite set, we could just store the global variables in some registers that we always reserve for global variables. However, in this old-fashioned way that most programming languages are built, you want to have separate compilations. So you want to compile one module and then a different module and then link them together with as little as inconvenience during the linking process as possible. So in particular, you don't want to rename registers. So it's okay to rename memory locations, but that's bad enough, and most libraries try to avoid that as well. So one reason is this separate compilation, since if we like compile one module with five global variables, we might allocate five registers here, and a different module with different number of global registers, then we would have to, like here from 1 to 5, here from 1 to 7, then we would have to rename them before we merge the code and link it. And this is very inconvenient. Okay, so what we do is we store global variables in memory, and then we have to patch addresses later on if we use the same addresses. So the principle remains, but this is what most linker infrastructures give you. They have a big table of indices where to patch addresses and change addresses afterwards. And a more modern solution is have to PC relative constants or PC relative locations. Does it work? No, that's only for constants, I think. Yeah, it doesn't really make. No. So it's like for global variables, you still have to patch your code. Okay, so a different observation why we need variables in memory is that a variable, for instance, X, that in C we can take its address And afterwards, we can pass the address of X around in our code, and then later on use a pointer access to write to X. Now, if we decide that, say, X lives in a register, then this is a problem because we cannot write, like, we cannot take the address of the register. A register doesn't have an address. So in that case, we need to make sure that the X is either a local or global variable. So if we have a locally, like if we have a function that declares a variable X and we take its address, it has to be a local variable. It cannot live in a register. Furthermore, like, so if we declare an array cannot be stored in registers because we cannot use an index to indirectly access the eighth or the ith register in a register set. That doesn't exist in processors. So we need to store an array always in memory so we can compute the address based on the index where we want to access the array. Okay, and the other thing is like we could always do some optimizations if we have to like store a struct or something bigger inside the main memory. We could just store some of them in registers, but in general this is an optimization problem. So also if we have X and we take the address of X, if we can determine that at a certain point in the function the address of X is not used anymore, then we can store it in a register again because it cannot be written through the address. Not that I know of, because that's a weird thing. That's Harvard. That's mixed everything together. No, it's not Harvard. It's just like the register file is part of the main memory. So you cannot take the fact that you can take the address of a register is just because the registers are in main memory. But that's just weird because all the main memory of the processor, like of the system, lives in this inside the processor. So that's not the case for larger memories. So I mean, so the Spark also has some very interesting functionalities where you can just like shift registers, like so you can it's kind of a shift by several indices, but that's not the same as array indexing either. Okay, so let's look at how to translate statements with the L value and R value concept. So now that we know that variables live in different locations, we need to like do the translation slightly different depending on where the variables live. So first of all, if we see an expression, we have to compute its right-hand side, and we can compute that into some register, first of all. And then we can copy the content of the register into whatever the symbol or the environment table tells us this left-hand side lives. So if the left-hand side is a variable, for instance, and we look up the variable and it says it's a register, then we simply move the result of the computation, which is an RI, to the register RJ. This is what we've done last week and the week before. So this is nothing new. But then if our register, if our variable X lives in local memory or in global memory, we need to write to the address in memory. So how do we do that? Well, so in general, if we have E1 is equal to gets the value of E2, we compute the R value in register RI as before. We just compute the value. Then we compute the address of E1 into different registers, so let's say RI plus 1. And then we have a special instruction that writes the value in E1 to E2, so it takes two registers. And this is the instruction. So it takes two registers. One contains the value to be written, the right-hand side, the second argument. And the first argument denotes the address. So the semantics is that we take the address in RI and we write the value in RJ to this address. So RI points to this position in memory and we store it there. And then, well, as before, if we have the statement for an expression, like if there's an expression or program and we, if there's a statement in the program that is an expression, for instance, an assignment expression, we just compute its value. And so if we then have an assignment, we had this definition before, I think. So if the left-hand side of the assignment is an X and it's a global variable, oh, what is this doing here? Oh, right. Oh, yeah, okay, sorry. So this is just like enumerating the different cases for computing the code for assignment. So if we have an assignment of the form X equals E, where X is stored in global memory as a global variable, So this is the question, this is the answer. So in the case, our left-hand side of the assignment is an X, and X is not stored in a register. We need to compute the address of the left-hand side, which is X, and then store it there. So there. That's the code generation in case the left-hand side is actually not a register. And how do we compute the L value of an expression? Well, the L value of an expression is generated by code L, and for variables, it's defined by loading A, the address of the register, the address of the variable into the register RI. And so this holds for global variables, which is the easiest because we care only about the address. Okay, so now if we have a function that actually has certain automatic variables, we need to make sure that we have some space on the stack to store these variables. So if we say call, we wind up with a stack where we have these three organizational cells, and then we can use the cells above it to store our local registers if we call another function. But in order to store local variables, we need to allocate more space there. And we do that with two special functions called alloc k and pop k. And k are here are constants. So all it does, it increments the stack pointer by k, and pop k decrements the stack pointer by k. And we assume that every variable uses one element except for structures and arrays which use more elements. So every base element like float and int, they just use one element. Okay, so let's see now how we can translate accesses to local variables. So if we have a function f, and if we have a local variable int x, and we want to store that on the stack, then we might have an entry that we have row of x is l comma, well, if it's the first variable, it's probably zero, so it's counting relative to the beginning of the stack frame. And then if x is then a local variable at the relative address A, so relative to the beginning of the stack frame, we have a special instruction which is called load RC, relative constant. So this takes this relative address A and adds FP to it. So if FP contains the address F, which points to the beginning of the stack frame, and we say load RC K, then we compute K plus F and store that in RI. So we have the address, the address of X, which is relative to the beginning of the stack frame, plus FP, which is the beginning of the stack frame, gives us the absolute address in memory where X lives. Okay, so the semantics is computing FP, the beginning of the stack, plus K, the index, the relative address inside the stack frame of that variable. Okay, so to summarize, the computation of the L value, so the address, is done as follows. So if we wanted to compute the L value of an of a variable X in register RI, then we need to check whether X is a global variable. In this case, we'd create load C, which just loads the constant into RI, and if it's a local variable, it is relative to the current stack frame, and the current stack frame is FP, and then we use a special mnemonic load relative constant load RC, which stores A plus FP into RI. Then, of course, if the the symbol table says that X lives in a register, then code L is not defined, because code L means compute the address, and a register does not have an address, generally. So a register doesn't have an address, and if during code generation we're faced with a problem that we need to generate the address of a register, then we bail out because something has gone wrong, because we shouldn't have allocated this X as a register. Okay, so for assignments we need to have a special case distinction for assignments. If we see the special pattern X is equal to something, then we need to check, is X a register? If so, we generate special code with a move instruction where we just look up the register for X. But if it's something else than X, or if X is not a register variable, we just compute code L, and then the rest is automatic. Okay, so now we've seen this load. We have some summary instructions now, because there's always the same. If we want to do pointer arithmetic and we want to read through pointers, we occasionally also want to read from a variable. So if a variable is living in memory and we want to have its value, we need to access it. And for that, we define the load command. So the load command loads into RI the value at the address RJ. So it's just reading from memory. So load RC A RI loads the relative constant of a variable at address A, so at variable that lives in the relative offset A inside a function, into RI, and RI load RJ RI stores the value at the address RJ. So this sequence of instructions stores the value R, copies the value from R, from the local variable at A to R. Is this the wrong way around? Oh, clever. Note that these are not the same sequence. So the first argument here is the target register, as usual, and the second argument is the address. So here I load the address of the variable X, and then I'm reading from this address, and RJ will then have the value of the variable X. So if I have if my X is a local variable living at address A, then this sequence of instructions will give me the value of X. So first I load the value of X into register RI, then I read from address RI and I get the value RJ, which contains the value of X. So this is how I compute the value of X if it lives in local memory inside the function frame. So if we're loading the value of a variable X into register RI, so if we compute the R value, the value of X, then we define a special function called load A and load R, and if it's a register, we use move. So these special, so basically, this and this sequence always appears every time we read a variable from memory. So we have a special function, special instruction that is called load A and load R. Load A is for absolute, for global variables, and load R is for local variables. And these I call macro instructions. So for read instructions, I have load R, so let's first do the relative one, which is load RC followed by load. And I also have load A absolute, which is load C followed by load. So load R gives me the value of a function local variable. Load A gives me the value of a global variable. And then analogously, I define store R to be the sequence. I'm loading the relative address A into the register RI, and then I'm storing the value of RJ, this argument here, at this address. So store R basically writes the value A into the relative address A, and store A is the same for the absolute address. Okay. So to summarize, if I have an assignment and my X is a global variable, I can just evaluate the right-hand side value. I can compute the address of the left-hand side X here, and then could emit the store instruction. But I can also use the but since this translates to load constant, I can use this macro instruction directly. Okay. So all these instructions are on a kind of cheat sheet. There's like a description of the RCMA machine on the web page, I think, by now. And all the translation scheme. No? No, I didn't. You did. I thought you did. Okay, so there will be one, and you should probably use that in the exercise. I can put it on later after the lecture. So there's all this code generation schemes I described there in a summarized way. Okay, so this is part of the summary. So load basically is just taking address and reading from it and stores the result in RI. And then we have these macro instructions that load from memory C at address C, and then this macro instruction load R, which is the relative version. And the same with store, absolute and relative. And if we only interested in computing addresses without storing them, then we use these original instructions load C for computing. So load C just loads, stores a constant basically in the register, and we can use that for addresses. So for just storing a, for loading a constant into a register, we can just use load C. C can be an address. And the relative constant just means relative to the FP pointer. So this is only really useful for local addresses in the local stack frame. And for registers, we have different mnemonics, namely move, which just moves the value from RJ to RI. And then we have a variant of this which takes a parameter K, which is an integer, that copies a whole block of values. And we need that for assigning complete structures to each other. It's like memcopy in C. Okay, so to summarize what we've done so far, we've talked about the difference between R values and L values. And we said that variables can have one of three different modes, being either register, local, or global variables. And within register variables, we have global, global registers and the local registers, the ones with the negative indices and the ones with the positive indices. So what were the negative indices for? The negative indices for the registers. So I said, no, we don't want to store globals in registers because that's complicated. We always want to store them in memory. So we want to make them global, as in... So, what is this? So this is a global variable with a G tag stored at address 7. And this is a register variable with a negative index minus 5. What did we use those for? So last week I made a big difference between negative registers, non-positive registers, 0, minus 1, minus 2, and the positive registers. And what was the difference? Well, who said that? Okay, what do you say? Okay, but what is stored in... So I don't want to know what, like, which is stored what now. There was callee safe, caller safe. But there was a distinction for the registers. Which indices do we use? What do we use positive indices for? What do we use the negative ones for? The negative ones? Did you say something about the negative ones?
Yeah, so the caller safe registers in the negative.
Yeah, that's callee safe, caller safe. That is true. But like what why? The question is why did it save that? Like what did it store in the negative registers during the function call? That was the question I wanted to ask. So, like, we always generated code with a positive index registers, right? Local computations we do in positive registers. And function local variables we store in positive registers. What are the negative ones? So which of these variables on this slide here are not function local, which are not local variables here? Which are not declared inside the function. Okay, so they're global registers. Okay, they're global variables. So we haven't dealt with global variables last week. So, but within this function here, there's some variables that are not declared locally inside F. The parameters. So the negative registers were for the parameters. The zero registers for the return value, as I said. The positive registers are for local computations, for temporary computations, and all the local variables. Okay. Now I want to build this in this symbol table here, or the address environment. So let's start with V. Where do I store V? So we just said negative registers. Parameters. So where do we store V? -1. And we give it the tag R for register. Where do we store W? -2. Okay, so let's look at X and Y. Where do we store those? As I just explained, I don't want to store global variables in registers. So there will be global variables. Let's pick some addresses. Oh dear, okay. And? 40? Let's take 40, why not? Is this okay? Like there's X, Y, can we do something like that? Can we say write to the address of X at 1? And set it to 5. Will this override Y? No, it's undefined. So these are two different variable declarations, and in C, two different variable declarations live at non-specific, like there's no relation between these variables. You cannot make any assumptions. So this is wrong C code. So Y can live at 40, at address 40. Okay, so what else do we have? A. What about A? Which register can I use for A? Or which memory location? What should I use? Speak up. register one. Why not? B, there's a B here. Okay, if I do that, don't copy that, I will generate code. And what will my code generation do? Yeah, so right here we're trying to compute the L value of B, and since it's living in a register, our code generation will bail out, telling us to fix our compiler. So no, we cannot store B in a register. So where do we store it? L, zero. So it's the first variable in the stack frame that is actually stored in the stack, so we just like use zero as index. And C? Index 2. 2 is good. Yeah. And then we can start emitting the code for this function starting with register 3, because that's unused. And then maybe we need more registers. All right. So this should be really clear. This is a very good question to ask. Okay. There's the solution. There's one solution. There's many solutions. Let's skip variadic functions. I don't think this is very important. Variadic functions, because you always have to have some sort of declaration, and the declaration has to be fitting to the call site. If you have an ellipses, then certain things are special, and there might be some ABI specific convention on how to use variadic functions, but in general, in C, the arguments are pushed from right to left onto the stack. And that is because then the registers, like let's call them parameter 1, parameter 2, oops, P, parameter N. Then we have PN all the way up to P1. And if we now want to access the first parameter, which we usually do, especially if we want to have a variadic function, then it's lying on top of the stack and it's a well-defined offset. No matter how many arguments there are on the stack, the first one is always the one right underneath the organizational cells. Okay, and then we can look at this argument and determine how much further down we need to access the stack. So our RCMA machine does not actually have the equipment to deal with variadic functions, or the macros, say. Or maybe it does. So, but I don't want to go into details. It's just that parameters are pushed from right to left due to variadic functions, so that the first parameter is on top of the stack. And last week I had the question whether the evaluation sequence of function arguments is defined, and I looked it up again, and it's undefined. The C compiler is free to evaluate the arguments in any order. They just have to all be evaluated before the function is invoked. Okay. Right, so there's like... So in the RCMA, if we can actually generate the code, I think we probably can generate code. So here we would just like, since the first argument is declared, we would just pass it in the first register, and the other one we all pass on the stack. So for variadic functions, we definitely need to be able to pass parameters on the stack and not only in registers. But I'm not going to detail how this actually works. It's written there, but it's not so relevant. Okay, then I will say a little bit about arrays. So an array... it's a piece of memory, and we can index into it, and thereby getting like quick access. And the ability to index into the array at with a constant time offset is like very important for the performance of many programs. So if we have an array of 11 elements in C, then these elements are called A0 to A10. And what we saw in the symbol table is that the array A is stored as either local variable inside a function or global variable at address which corresponds to A0. So at the first element of the array is actually the address of the array. Now, if our array, so an array access then computes the value of an array element and then writes to it. And the address of a certain array element is determined by the base type. So you could have an array of an array or an array of a struct, and the struct will be larger than one element in memory. So suppose that this function here with the argument in the middle computes the space of a type, of a C type. Then we say that if T is a base type, so if it's int or float, then it just uses one cell or double, it uses one cell. And if it's an array of k elements, then it uses k times the size of the base element. So if this is an array of 10 elements of 10 elements of int, the size of this array will be 100 elements. Okay, and right, so this is then, if we have a sequence of declarations, well, how do we compute the possible starting addresses? We just give them consecutive addresses. So the first one will set to live at address 1, and the next one will look up the size of the first one and the address of the first one, and that gives us the address of the next one. So we just allocate them consecutively. So this is the most basic thing. We could also shuffle them around afterwards. And the size of a type can be computed at compile time. It has to be able to be computable at compile time. And this function is exactly what the size of operation in C returns you. Okay. So how do we translate an array access? Well, we just need to define code L to compute the address and code R to compute the value of an array access. So let's suppose we have the following declaration. We declare a variable A, which is an array of base type T and of C elements. So if we wanted to compute the address, so if we want to write to the array, what we do is we look up at the base address of the array, we compute the size of the base type T, and then we multiply it with the access index that we're currently seeing. So the index is given by some other expression E1, and the array itself could be a computed value. So we compute first the value of E1 and the value of E2, which we interpret as an address. Then we load the constant that denotes the size of an individual array element. We multiply this size with the array index E1, and we should add, this is the base address, this is R1. This is wrong, isn't it? This is the index. We multiply the index by the size of the individual array element, and that gives us a relative offset, or an offset into the array relative to the beginning, and then we add the beginning address of the array, which is an RI+1, and that gives us the access address. This is the value in RI. Okay, I'll fix that on the slides. Okay, and then C, an array, like this code scheme, code generation scheme shows that it's like an array is just an address. So we just compute another address out of an array access. So an array is simply a pointer, and it's a constant, pointer constant, if it's a global array, and it's the first field of this array. And if we want to compute the R value, so just the value of the variable A without it being indexed, it is actually just the L value, because the L value is the address of the array. This might be a bit confusing, but an array is just a pointer. And if we just want to, if we use this array variable, we're just using the pointer in, or the value, which is an address inside of, which is the address of that variable. Okay, so, and in that sense, then these expressions are all the same if the base type is int. Like type checking wise, this wouldn't work, but if we ran out code translation on it, this would be always yield the same code if the base element size would be 1. So since it's not type correct, this wouldn't also, this couldn't really generate code, but like under this assumption that the type size is 1, this would generate all the same code. Okay, structures are orthogonal to arrays, kind of. So structures allow you to define compound types, so types that are composed of several other types. So in C, we have, we talked, during type checking, we talked about the possibility of defining equality between two structures to be the set of access paths that structures allow. This would be structural equality. So if the structure of the array is equal, then the arrays are equal. This is not the the path chosen in C. In C, it's nominal type equivalence. So nominal means by name. So if we have two C structures that have different names but the same fields, these two structures are not equal. In principle, the compiler can then rearrange the fields, in principle. In practice, this doesn't work because due to separate compilation, then if we include the same header file and a struct here is the compiler reshuffles the elements in that struct and the compiler uses different shuffling here, then you link it and then the program wouldn't work anymore. So this principle possibility does not, like, in practice it means every C compiler will have one scheme to generate the layout of a structure and this is fixed. Yeah, so I think there's the reason for that is that, like, you're able to do pointer arithmetic. You're able to allow to take the difference between two members of a struct and then add that to one pointer to the struct and get the second member, so to say. Yeah, there's some possibilities that are probably put in there because people have done it, not because it was a good idea. Okay, so... But since structure equality is nominal by name, two different structures can use the same name and they don't clash. Okay, in order to translate a structure, all we do is we need an address to the structure and then we need to add the offset to that member inside the structure. And in order to track this offset, we need a special environment, row st, for each structure ST. So for each structure, we kind of have a little symbol table that tells us at which relative offsets, so offsets relative to the beginning of the structure, that member lives. So if we have a structure with two elements A and B, and we declare variable X to be that structure, then, okay, so X is at least the size of the sum of the different elements, so at least two here. And then, for instance, we could have a symbol table row ST that maps A to the relative offset 0 and B to 1. So relative to the beginning of the structure, A is at offset 0, B at offset 1. So in general, the size of the structure is the size of all the elements. Roughly speaking, you can add padding. And similar to allocating global variables, we could say, well, so these are the different members. The first member should live at offset 0. The ith member, it lives at the offset of the previous member plus its size. And with that definition, we can just create a symbol table for structures. So if we now access an element of a structure E, then E, it needs to be an address, and we just add this relative offset to the beginning of the address, and that is the address we return. So this is when we calculate the L value, that is the address of E.C, which usually, if we have E.C is equal to something, you need to assign something to this E.C, and we've seen that if we read a variable, that means compute the value. So in the expression in the right-hand side, if we read an expression which is not a register-allocated variable, we just compute the address and then load from that address. So this will work here as well. Okay, so all of this array and structure business hints at the fact that addresses are very important, and indeed C allows to use addresses as kind of first-class members. You can just like ask for the address of a certain variable. So there's only two operations, which is, and the one that is really special is the AND operation, which takes an address. So in order to, we need to create a pointer, that's the AND operator. So by that, like we do that by taking the address of a variable, and then we need to dereference a pointer. And we've seen that with the arrays, that there's dereferencing is going on already, but like there's a special operator, namely the star. So star x is used to dereference the address in x, so in order to access the value that x points to. Okay, so we create pointers by this ampersand, which yields the L value of x. And since the register doesn't have a L value, if we take the address of x, x cannot be in a register, so it has to be a local variable. And this is the code generation scheme. Taking the value of end E means the address of E, which is just code L of E by definition. So if we take the structure, the address of x.b, Well, this example really belongs to the other page. Oh, does it? Okay. So this is kind of dereferencing. Does this example belong here? Okay, so he wanted to generate code for x.b, and x is a structure being allocated at address 13. Then we just load the structure and the offset and add it, and that's the L value. Now, if we wanted to take the address of x.b, then we would call code ri of this expression, and that's exactly this address that we compute here. So if we wanted to have this address of the second member of x, we just get 14 as a result, because that is the result of this computation. Okay, the second operation when it comes to pointers is the dereferencing operator, which just yields kind of the contents or allows you to store something at that address. So if we're interested in the contents, we're interested in the R value, in the value of an expression. So star E evaluated to the value means that we're computing the address of E, and we load whatever is stored under that address, and that's the result. So there's the second example. So in C, so suppose we have these declarations, and we have this rather complex expression. I think I might just do the first bit. It's a good exercise to do that at home. So in C, we have a special syntax with an arrow to access a field of a structure where the structure is actually denoted by a pointer to the structure. So if E is a pointer to the structure, then E arrow A will dereference E and then access the element A in there. And the reason why there is an arrow as a syntactic construct is that writing this is just horrible, because you have to put parentheses around the star operator, since otherwise it would read E.A, so take E as a structure, take the A element, and then dereference that A element, like the value of the A element, rather than first dereferencing the E pointer. So this is just like following what we've seen on the last slides. So if we read it like this, so first of all, we load the R value of star E, which is just the L value E of E, so it's just the address. Then we load the constant of this table for the structure T, so this could be rho T, which gives us the relative offset to the beginning of the structure, and we add these two elements together, and then we get a pointer to the A element. I don't know, is there an example? Yes. So this is the more complex example for all these declarations and how to generate code for this. I advise you to do that at home. It should be clear now from what I've said on the last slides. But for the time reasons, I think I'll skip that now, and maybe you have some more questions about everything at the end. This is the result. Okay, so let's talk about R values of functions. So functions live in memory, have an address. So if they have an address, we can use that address in C. So similar to arrays, function names are simply pointers, simply constant pointers to the code. So the R value of these pointers is the address of the first instruction of that function. So if we have a function pointer G and we dereference G to get the function, and then that function is called, then we can write it like this. But actually, see also, because it doesn't really make sense to distinguish the value, the function as a value and the function as an address, G also allows us to just write G. And if G is a pointer in that points to a function, it's dereferenced. So the dereferencing of function pointers is actually ignored. So, which means if we compute R, code R, the R value, we just get the address back. And similar, if E is actually a function pointer, this is the same as computing the R value of E itself. So this is a bit confusing. But normally you can just, you can just distinguish it because you have a symbol table, and the symbol table can tell you whether it's a function or a variable. But so there are some corner cases in the code generation. So we talked about function arguments and return values, that function arguments are passed in negative registers. Now the question is, if we pass a structure by value in particular, so this is just a structure, it's not a pointer, and we just pass the whole structure. How do we pass the structure? So this depends on the architecture that you're compiling for, but usually there's very complicated rules. So one possibility and one simple possibility is that the caller passes a pointer to the structure. And the problem is, if I pass a pointer to the structure that's living somewhere, maybe locally, then the callee can modify the structure. And this is not quite C, or this is not quite the intended meaning, because if I pass an argument, so for instance, if I pass an integer, then the callee can modify this integer parameter at will. So if I pass a parameter x, and inside the function x, the user applies, says x plus plus, then that local integer is changed, that the local register is changed, but the integer that has been passed by the caller is not changed. Now, if I have a function f, and inside I have these declarations here, and then down here I call g with point t, Oh, well, yeah, it says that. Okay, fine. We can just use that. So if I then call the function disk to origin, then I don't expect that the local variable pointee is modified by distance to origin. And this shouldn't happen in practice. So what is the solution? Well, each time I pass a structure by value, I make a local copy on my local stack and take the address of this local copy and then pass this copy to the caller. Then the caller can modify the structure at will. And when the callee returns, I just free this space. I don't use the space on the stack anymore. And it's no harm done. And the original structure is still in place. So if then, again, if f calls distance to origin, I don't pass point t, but I pass p prime. And here I say structure xy, int xy, p prime is equal to point t. So I make a local copy, and then I pass the address of the local copy, and then the callee cannot modify anything but the local copy. Oh, is it? No, it's a... Oh, yeah, it's a type def, sorry. Okay, let's assume it's like this. These are just declarations. Now it's a function call. Like this. So, this is now a C program. Sorry. Yeah, it's a bit confusing. And this might seem very weird and inefficient, but let's do that. So the code, so how do I copy a structure? So if E is a structure, then I just compute the value, the address of E into R register RI plus 1, and then I move K bytes to RI. And then I have the address, at address RI, I have a copy of the structure. And that's it. Problem is I need to first allocate sufficient memory at RI, but that's an orthogonal problem. That's this allocate business. So this is the definition of move K, and it's like mem copy. You just like copy K elements starting from address RJ to address RI and following. Okay. So this now, what we have now is like a translation scheme for expressions, local expressions, for local variables, global variables, for while, for, and case statements. We have just covered structures and arrays and pointers. So basically this covers all of C, the core C, but then there's obviously some interface to the operating system which provides you with more memory if you need it, which is the heap. So let's look at the heap. So the heap is not very particularly exciting. It's just two more functions, malloc and free. And I will just cover it so that you know how the RCMA machine will cope with that. Normally it's a bit more complicated and it's a bit different with an operating system where paging is used, where we have different, where addresses are fixed and then you can have different pages inside this address space. So here we suppose that if we wanted to have dynamic data structures and whose lifetime does not allow us to store them on the stack, which requires this last in first out allocation order, then we need just some sort of memory where we can allocate these data structures, and we call that the heap. Now, if we have this as our writable data memory, then it has a zero address, and that's where the stack starts, and then we do some computation, and the stack pointer is here. The extreme pointer that we had in this organizational cell we haven't dealt with yet. So all the extreme pointer says is the maximum value that this current stack frame can grow to. This is usually statically computable, or at least you can create a dynamic computation that sets the EP to the right value. So if you have locally a local array of a size that is passed as parameter, then even then at runtime you can just compute the EP exactly. So EP just says, what is the maximum extent of stack that I need to run my function? So what is the point of the extreme pointer? Well, it tells us how far the stack grows unless we call another function. And so the idea is to like then allocate the heap on the other side of the stack. So we have some, whenever we say give us a bit more memory, we just like start from the top, from the maximum address that we have available, and allocate a chunk down here and further on. And if we ask for another one, we go like this. And we have a so-called new pointer that points to the last cell that is used. And whenever the extreme pointer becomes greater or equal to the new pointer, then we know we ran out of space, because we have so much heap space and we cannot allocate more stack space, and then our program fails miserably. So this is a very basic setup of allocating heap allocated memory. It's not very practical, but it has been used, if you remember pre-Windows times, with MS-DOS. That is exactly how it's been done. Like without paging, you would have this setup. So the second heap may not overlap, and this is basically summarizing what I just said. So an overlap could happen if the SP is incremented, or when the NP is decremented. So each time we rather than checking each time when the SP is implemented, we just check each time you call a function, and that's implicit in the call to in the call instruction. So if we run out of stack space, we have to abort the program. It's very difficult to continue. But if we run out of heap space, we could just like make malloc return null, as in a pointer that is zero. So the EP is just there so that we don't have to check every time we allocate something on the stack, but only when we enter a function. So it's just an optimization. But each time we allocate something on the heap, we need to check the new pointer, whether it's small or equal to EP. So the EP is set and checked by... So the call stores the EP in the organizational cells, but there's actually this enter construct, which takes a constant, and it just pushes the EP up relative to the stack pointer. So it sets it to the stack pointer plus this constant Q, and then checks whether this EP pointer has exceeded the new pointer, and then it says stack overflow. For malloc, well, if we have this new pointer up here, and we say malloc E number of bytes, then we compute the value of E, and we have a special instruction new that reduces the new pointer, and the value of the result. So if reducing the new pointer would be smaller than the extreme pointer, then we return null because memory allocation has failed, and otherwise we are because our addresses grow upwards, so we return the new after we've done the subtraction. We return the current value of the new pointer, because if we need 20 bytes and we access byte number 5, we will take the new pointer plus 5 bytes, and we wind up right in the newly in the free space that we just allocated. Okay, freeing memory is also an option. You don't have to. We will run out of memory if you don't. Okay, so if we free memory manually using a function called free, which is what you always do in C, mostly, then afterwards you could still access the space, and this space might already have a new owner, if there was another malloc. And it's called a dangling reference. And another problem is if you have a lot of malloc and free calls, you might have enough space, like in the little parts that are free, but you might not have a single bit of memory that contains enough space. So with paging, all this is not such a problem anymore, but you can have still fragmentation. This is called fragmentation inside a page. And if so, on MS-DOS, this was certainly a problem. On macOS, prior to version 10, they had a very interesting setup. So the very first Mac in 1984, every user program, if it wanted to dereference a heap-allocated piece of memory, it would always use some sort of indirection. It had a cell which contained a pointer to the heap, and then the operating system could go and reshuffle all these free and allocated pieces of memory, and it would just rewrite this indirection pointer to point somewhere else if it had moved a piece of memory. This required very you had to be very careful there, because each time you call a function you call out to the operating system, then these cells could have changed. And so if you take an address from a structure element, say in here, by looking through this pointer to this cell, and you store it somewhere else in some other variable, and then you call an operating system function, your structure might have moved over here. And Microsoft wasn't very good at doing this, so the Internet Explorer, when you installed it and ran it, it would keep some pointers in memory, call an operating system function, which could reshuffle these memory regions. Wouldn't do it very often, but occasionally, and that made the whole operating system crash. So thank God we've got paging now. Okay, possible implementations of free. Let's just do this. Okay, we don't do anything. Let's suppose there's some garbage collection or whatever. Okay, putting it all together. So before we execute a program, the virtual machine sets the stack pointer to -0, because we always increment the stack and then write it. The free pointer, extreme pointer, 0, the program pointer, starts at the beginning. The heap is at the maximum address that we can, that we allow to use. Actually, it should probably be max plus 1. Then let's suppose our program has a few variable, global variable definitions, and then n function definitions, and one of these functions is called main. And then we generate code for each of these functions. We generate code to initialize global variables. And then we emit the code to call main and one instruction halt, so that the program also stops when we've done that, done everything. So actually, maybe we should put this at the beginning, so that the code that we emit is actually, that calls main, is actually at address 0. Might be sensible. Oh yeah, so the program has to have one main function. I think we've seen this before. This is now, what is new is that we always have this enter instruction that tells us how large the EP will, to what value the EP has to be set. So if we have k variables in memory, we just pretend we allocate them on the heap, when really it's just like the first k addresses. Because the heap, at the beginning of the program, the stack pointer, sorry, did I say heap? I meant stack. So, again, so the program starts, stack pointer 0. We say alloc k to allocate k units of memory for global variables. And then we know that all these global variables are relative to address 0. And so they're just absolute addresses then. Okay, so we set the extreme pointer to these global variables plus 3 cells. And so this is EP. Sorry, points down here. The 3 cells is the register R1, which contains the address of main. And we save register R0 and R1 because this is the return value. I don't know why we save this. Because we don't need it afterwards. But I think this follows our, does this follow our code generation scheme? R0 is the return value. Okay, I'm not sure. I can check this. I don't think this is really relevant. Okay, we call the function, we call mark, which copies these organizational cells, we call the function at main and we say halt, and then we have the code for all the other functions. So basically this is new, and I think this is just mistakes that I've carried over from the last time we had this slide. So k is the number of sec locations for global variables. There are on the stack in principle, but not. But since the stack starts at zero, it looks like at absolute addresses. We just reuse the operations. Oh, okay, there we go. Right, so this follows the code generation scheme. That's why these instructions are generated. But because this is larger than this, we don't save anything. There we go. Yeah, and row contains the address of all functions and global registers. Okay, so the translation of a function is modified so that we have an alloc k. If we have k local variables or automatic variable declarations. So and we also have enter for heap allocation. So if q has to be the number of stack cells that we need maximally during the running of this function, and alloc reserves the stack space for local variables. Can we define local arrays in F? Let's see. Maybe. I think we might be able to do that, but the problem is that Q is a constant, and so we cannot emit a different. We would need to have to compute the size of the maximum size of the stack frame based on the size of the array. Since enter only takes a constant, there's no instruction to that. Okay, function calls, very similar to before, except we have a pop k, which removes the stack cell which have been generated when, in case we had some, we pass some structures by value, then we would allocate stack, and then we need to pop k that to free all these stack locations. Okay, so as you might have seen throughout this lecture, we had a lot of instructions that looked like this. Or we might generate instructions pop 0 if we don't allocate any structures, or if we don't pass any structures by value. And then we had things like moves between registers. And sometimes if you look at the code, you can just say, oh, let's just rewrite it and rename the registers. Or we had multiplication. Maybe R7 contains a constant or something like that. Who knows? So you could say, well, let's just like make our translation scheme more clever, so that for certain special cases we generate special code, so that the code is better. But in practice, this is not a very good idea, because it's much easier to implement optimizations that is general transformations of the program that improve the speed of the program, that improve the use of registers. And so one example are people optimizations that just look at code sequences like this and simply replace them with simpler ones. I think this should be, yeah, I think this sequence is a bit bogus. Okay, and different thing is that we use an infinite number of registers, and that is not really possible in practice. So we need to but it's a nice setup, because the code is very easy to generate, and even in compiler infrastructures like LLVM, they have an infinite number of variables, and then later they map it to registers. So very same idea. So because real processes have a fixed number of registers, we need to assign the infinite virtual set of registers to a physical set of finite set of registers in the processor. So in case a register RI is not used currently, we can then reuse it somewhere else, and this is the basic idea of what is called register allocation. So we try to use the physical registers of the processor as much as possible, and sometimes we have more than, say, 32 registers alive, and then we store them on the stack, and that's called spilling. So what we need is to determine when a register is not in use, so when it's not live or when it's dead. And then we can map several virtual registers to the same processor register if only one of them is alive at a certain time. And this is all addressed in the lecture called program optimization, which will be done in the next term. So I'll just give you a taste of this, how this looks like. So this is the faculty function that I had earlier. This is the code for the faculty function. You see some redundant statements that you can immediately remove by people optimization. So you see return, return. You can just say, well, remove this return because it's not needed, because here's a return. And here's a return jump. You can immediately remove this return, remove this jump because it's never reached. Okay, so these are people optimizations. And for the registers, so here are the register. This is the return value. Sorry, this is the argument. This is the return value. And these are four temporary registers I use during the translation. This is following the translation scheme. So what you see here is we save the register parameter into R1. And what I have written down here is a U for usage. I'm using the register R-1. I need it at this point. And here I say I define the register R1. And here I'm using a register and defining it at the same time. And so the idea is that I draw a line between each U and a D if it exists. So if there's no D, I don't need to draw a line. So this looks like this. So now I have some sort of intervals here where registers are so-called live. So between a definition point and a usage point, the register is live. I cannot just simply throw it away because the value is needed. But note there are many little spots here where the value of the register is not needed. And in this case, what I can do, for instance, I can look at this range here and move it over here, and then I can update the code. So instead of using register R3 here, I can use register R0, and I replace R0 and R0 here with R3 here with R0. And the same code will run as before, but I need fewer registers. So I do this everywhere, and you see that register 3 and 4 are now never used. So I can emit the code onto a register that onto a processor that needs only 4 registers instead of 6. Okay. So this is the general idea. Details are not needed for the exam because you can just like listen to the next lecture. Okay, so register allocation is also cool because it removes unnecessary move instructions if done cleverly, and you sometimes it's not possible, you have to spill it, and you can use a single static assignment, which is a special form, a special representation of the program where a variable is only written once. So that's done in program optimizations. And then you can do better liveness analysis. So for instance, if you know that y is actually never not used, and you compute a new x value, then x is also dead. So, and then you have trouble that save log just like takes this whole lot of registers and saves them before it calls the function, then it returns and restores them. Then it looks like all these registers are needed before the function call, but if they're never used after the function call, they're actually dead. So an optimization has to be a bit more clever about these. So my question is, what is optimal? What is an optimal optimization? This is done in program analysis. So how do we do this all quickly with good data structures? It's also program analysis. So I guess this is an advertisement for program analysis. Okay, so that's me done. Don't just the last three slides were just for entertainment. The rest was very fast. I know I didn't ask many questions today because I wanted to not overrun. Well, thank you very much for attending this lecture, and I'll take some questions if you have some now. Thank you.